Today's Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all the men and women who are serving or have served in the United States Navy Carrier Force.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And here we are, another program live from the studios of WDEO right in here, beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan, the garden spot of the Midwest, and we're here on Veterans Radio. That's right, bringing you another hour of military stories. You know, it's interesting, there's going to be a change in the military channel. It's going to be called the American Heroes Channel. Oh, by the way, this is sitting with me. Right,
very rude.
Yeah, this is right here. This is my partner. Well, you know, sometimes I'm not sure if he's, like a ghost figure. But he's here today. Remember, we had all your cards and letters went out a couple of weeks ago when Dale had his little bit of surgery. So he's back here all well. He's with me in the studio. My partner, Dale Thronberry.
Hey, thank you very much, Bob. And also thank you all of our listeners that sent emails and texts and so forth. It was nice to get those. Everything is coming out just fine.
Oh,
thank
like
you very
that.
Much.
No pun intended
no
there.
No pun intended there.
And running the board is the lovely Nina.
Good morning, Bob and Dale. I have a couple of joiners with me in the studio, but we are all excited to be here.
And we do have a few guests today, but before we do that, there is a solemn moment. Dale, do you want to fill us in on
yes,
that?
Yes, I just wanted to pass along Veterans Radio condolences to George Perrault in the passing of his wife, Lois. George is a very active veteran here locally in the Vietnam Veterans of America 310. His wife, Lois, passed away, and she was very active in the auxiliary for the VVA and a number of other activities. And so we want to pass along our condolences to George and his family. The viewings are on Sunday, and you can find this information on MLive. And the obituary will be there. As I mentioned, the viewing is on Sunday, and the funeral is Monday morning.
Joe has been on our program a couple of times. He was one of the, what would you say, guards at the...
He was one of the guards
at
John Kennedy's funeral in the Capitol. He was one of the, in the famous picture in Life magazine, he's one of the guards at the head of the casket, I believe it was.
And that was when Jackie and, I believe, the little girl went up to the
right,
casket.
Was there when they both came up and melted the casket. George is a great guy, and Lois was terrific too. And she fought a long battle, 11 years with cancer. And so, again, our condolences and sympathies go to George and his family.
By the way, folks, you can find all these past programs on our archives on our website, and that's about to be change, isn't that right? Give us a little real quick update. Boy, we got some exciting things.
Well, we're going into the 21st century,
evidently.
That's what they told us. They're dragging us into the 21st century. We will be introducing a new website, hopefully in the next week to 10 days, and we'll let everybody know what's going on.
But
it's going to be much more interactive. You're going to be able to leave your comments there. You're going to be able to listen to the programs and sort of like a news article, you're going to be able to write down what your thoughts are about that particular program while it's going on. So we're very excited about that. Also, there's going to be more space for supporters and sponsors of Veterans Radio to get their message out. And so it will be coming up very shortly. And I'm very excited.
I've seen the previews. I can't wait.
So I think it'll be very, very cool, and we'll be up with the times.
After 10 years,
yes,
right?
Yes,
after
10 years, we thought how far advanced we were having a website for 10 years, but you know, it's sort of like everything else. It needs to be updated. So we've remodeled it, and I think that you're going to like it.
And you'll be able to go on the archives and archive programs and make copies. Copies of programs, and you're going to be able to see what we look like. And
well, I don't know if you want to see that, but that's why we chose radio.
So you know the face behind the voice there. But we have today as my guest second time on the program, author Thomas Wildenberg, and he wrote Ship Killer, which is a story about torpedoes. That was a very popular program we had because I got two emails from two different listeners who did go out and buy the book, Ship Killer, all about the development of torpedoes, success, failures, whatever. And that was very exciting. So Thomas Wildenberg will be on our program. He's an historian and an author of the book I have right here in my hand, Destined for Glory. It's all about the Battle of Midway and the advent of carrier-borne Air Force, Navy, I want to say attack planes, but the whole idea of the carrier concept. But before we get to that, Dale, and I know this is kind of a surprise, but today at breakfast you said something, and if you could just give us about a minute, what's this about a mortgage?
What? Sorry.
Who knew, folks? Who knew? I asked him, I said, where did you get this? We had it on the program. We did.
Well, you know, we always like to bring new and exciting news, and I guess this wasn't new and exciting, but I was not aware of it. For all of you out there who have ever had a VA loan and it's paid off, you can get another one. And whether it's for the same house, will be considered a refinance, but if you are going to move, let's say that you're retiring and you're going to be going down to Tennessee or Florida, wherever it happens to be, you can get a new mortgage as long as your previous mortgage was paid off.
And the first thing you need is?
Your DD-214.
Oh, yeah.
The lien payoff that shows that the mortgage has been paid off, and then you can get your renewed certificate of eligibility. You take that to your local mortgage company, wherever that happens to be, and they look at that. They look at your credit rating, and they go, hey, we did it once, we'll do it again.
Amen
and
to that.
And so I was really, obviously I was very excited about that. You know, we're trying to figure out what we're going to do in our golden years, as they say.
I think that's way cool, way so cool. I'm glad that we can pass on that kind of information.
So just go to the VA.gov and look up VA loans, and all the information is there. You fill out the application for the certificate of eligibility online. And it's got a list of the article. You can upload all this, you know, this high-tech stuff. What do we know, right? You can upload your mortgage payoff. You can upload your DD-214. It's all there. Boop, and I get a letter back 2 days. I got a letter.
And if you don't have a DD-214, you can email me, and I'll give you the information how you can obtain your own copy of your DD-214. Wow.
Right.
That's really exciting. And that's where it all starts, folks. You go to your VA, your local VA, and you walk in the door and say, here I am. Get me started. And that's how it starts. We've had the director, Mr. Rob McDivitt, from the Ann Arbor VA on five times at least, four or five, and talks about come to the VA. That is the gatekeeper. That's where it all begins. So that's way cool. That is really cool information.
And I got one more thing.
Fire.
I can do that for next week's program so I can do my little promo because I don't know if I'm going to. But anyway, recently in the news yesterday it came about, the President of the United States is going to award the Medal of Honor to 19 veterans whose, I guess, application for the Medal of Honor was turned down because of their ethnicity. Jews, blacks, Latinos
really
did not get their awards. They received Silver Stars and Navy crosses and so forth, but they did not get the Medal of Honor. And so this commission was instituted by Congress and back in 2002, so it's not political, folks. And they went back through all of the records of something like 600 veterans who have received, you know, the second highest award. Reevaluated some of them. They've got 19 that are going to be awarded next month at the White House. It's going to be the largest Medal of Honor recipients gathering, or I guess you could say, since World War II for the people that are going to receive them. Unfortunately, out of the 19, only three still survive, but they're from World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. So this is a great story, and we're going to be doing this next week.
We're going to be covering that.
We're going to be doing it next week.
Oh,
Dwight.
Okay.
Yep, Dwight Zimmerman. Hopefully, if you watch listen to the program, Dwight wrote a book called Uncommon Valor, which was about six Medal of Honor recipients from the Iraq-Afghanistan conflicts. Okay. So he's our resident expert on the Medal of Honor. He's going to be here. The writer of the article, Scott Wilson, has already committed to being on the program next week. So we're going to have them and some Medal of Honor recipients. So it's going to be a great program. So March 1st, 9 o'clock. Set your timer or get up early and listen to the program.
Way cool. Way cool.
This is what we do, folks.
Speaking of promo, we're going to be having the Generals back. We had such a huge, huge response to that. The Generals, that's right, with not one, but two guest speakers this time who did their research on Eisenhower. We're going to eliminate MacArthur this time, so it's going to be Eisenhower, Bradley, and Patton.
Oh,
that's coming on March the 29th. March 29th, we're going to have a repeat of the Generals. By the way, if you have a question today for our guest, for me, Dale, whomever, 877-573-7825. One more time, 877-573-7825. And as I reach over here, hey, I push the magic button, and on the line with me right now is a gentleman who I've had on the program before, but I want to give an update. This gentleman, he's born in right around Detroit, Michigan. He has a wonderful project that he started, a nonprofit. The flags around the memorial in Detroit and around the area of honor and around the whole veterans, everything were a bit in tattered. Well, anyway, I'll let him tell you folks about that. Mike Solvac, welcome to Veterans Radio.
How you doing, Bob? Can you hear me good?
Oh, we can hear you loud and clear, man.
Thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
So how did this all get started?
Basically, being in the flag business, we own a flag company as well for about 5 years now. We're in the Detroit area, but we're in the suburbs, but we're considered Detroit area and so on. But we were down in Hart Plaza one day going to a dinner we were having at. And I was walking through Hart Plaza and noticed these, like, poles. I thought at first they were light poles. But being somebody who works on flight poles all the time, installs flight poles, and that's the main company's business, I came to realize that these light poles were actually flight poles, and they were top of the line, 50-foot flight poles that the city of Detroit must have installed years ago, and that they were in disrepair and did not have any flags flying on them.
Well, then that got you to start a nonprofit, the Revolution Flag Group. You started that. And how long has that been in business right now, about a year?
Well, the Revolution Flag Group is our profit business. Our foundation is called the Revolution Flag Foundation. And we started that around the time that we started this project. So, we're in partnership with the city of Detroit, so a public-private partnership to do this project. We need to raise $60,000, and our for-profit business is donating our services, but we need to raise the money to finish off the rest of the project, because as a company, we can't do this on our own. We need the community support to get these 50-foot flagpoles repaired and to get the flags back up.
Well, we're having a bad connection, something. Are you on speakerphone?
No, I'm not on speakerphone, Bob. Can you hear me better now?
Well, that's a little better, whatever it is that you're doing. So you're raising money to replace these flags and to get that, and I know that you've already started doing that. You also market flags. So, folks, you want to know where you can get flags, you want to go to this particular website. This is somebody that does support veterans, his family, his grandfather. He has a very patriotic family. I did talk to his mom, Connie, and, of course, the lovely Rachel. Does she happen to be there? She's right there.
Yeah, she's in the living room right now.
Well, that's good. That's good. So, anyway, if you all, why don't you give us that website real quick?
Our website is www.revolutionflaggroup.com, and we have information about the Hart Plaza project there as well. And we've also decided that if you buy any flags from us or a flagpole or anything until we do the project in May, proceeds of the profits will go to support the Hart Plaza project.
Okay, so I have it right here, www.revolutionflaggroup.com. Revolutionflaggroup.com or call 866 866-319 866-319-4798. Let me give you that again, 866-319-4798. Folks, this is the 150th anniversary of the beginning of Arlington. All of us vets want to have a flag for that one, this Memorial Day. And there is a big push on now to show our patriotism, show what we've really, how we feel, and display the flag. You want to go to revolutionflaggroup.com, 866-319-4798. Anything you want to add on that, Dale?
No, I just think it's great that somebody is going around there taking care of these tattered flags. Our partner, Gary Lilly, was notorious for going around. If you see a terrible flag, he would go in and confront the store owner or whoever owned the property and say, hey, you need to replace this flag. And he'd give them about, I don't know, maybe an hour, and if they didn't take it down, he'd be out there taking the flag down and putting a new one up.
There was an abandoned gas station in Ann Arbor, and that flag, they never took the flag down. They moved everything out, everything out of the tools, everything, oils, and that flag was flying. I told Gary about it. I said, well, maybe we ought to go there at night, Gary, because it is private property. I think we finished the program at 10 o'clock. 10:10, I'm driving home. There's Gary on the corner. I mean, it's the middle of the morning, folks, bright sunshine. He's taking that flag down. And, yeah, right. So, anyway.
Bob, in the Detroit area, that's a chronic problem now. When people leave their businesses, they just leave the tattered flagpole up, and they leave the flag flying like miserable. And it's kind of a problem in the Detroit metro area, so.
Well, we certainly admire what you're doing.
Well,
no problem. Thank you.
It's stuff like you're doing, Mike, and here we are getting this information out to our listeners. So one more time, if you want to go now, you also Mike's business also has the brackets. There you go. I wanted to call them holders, but brackets. You can get different size flags. The whole McGillan, and this also is the 70th anniversary of Normandy and of the Battle of the Ardennes. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff this year, and you do want to fly the flag. So one more time, go to revolutionflaggroup.com or 866-319-4798. Mike, we want to thank you for being on the program. We'll have you on again to get a little update before that big date coming up in Arlington. Will you come back on the program?
Absolutely. Thank you, Bob. You know, we love Veterans Radio. We love the veterans. And if you guys can support this project, our listeners out there, we would love it. It's the American flag, and you'll support the Detroit metro area and Michigan as well.
Thank you very much. Wow. There we go. Okay. Whew. Man, that was a heck of a opening right here. So we're going to be right back with our author, Mr. Thomas Wildenberg, who's going to be talking about his book, Destined for Glory, Aircraft carriers, planes, etc., right after these important messages. Don't go away.
You're listening to Veterans Radio live on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or listen to us online at AveMariaRadio.net.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now, we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Yeah, Rutgers away. A little salute to all of our Navy veterans out there, those that are serving right now and those that are and have served in the past. Right now, my guest today is Mr. Thomas Wildenberg. He's a historian specializing in the development of naval aviation and logistics at sea. He's the author of several books on naval history, the one that we're going to be covering today, Destined for Glory. And I want to welcome Mr. Wildenberg to Veterans Radio. How you doing, Tom?
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
I'm fine. How's things in Tucson?
It's gorgeous.
Oh.
It's just a beautiful sunrise.
Well,
you know, I live right near the mountains, and the clouds are pink behind the mountains. It's beautiful.
Well,
and nice and sunny today.
I know you get the sunshine, but don't forget there's something called water. And whenever you folks down there in Tucson need some water, we'll sell you some up here in the Great
okay.
Lakes. This is the first time, too, that the Great Lakes has frozen over in something like 100 years. All of them. Very interesting. Tom, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio. We had your book before, Ship Killer, story all about torpedoes, their development, their failures, their successes, and now we have one which really piqued my interest a lot. I love carriers. I love the idea of the aircraft carrier. Gosh, if I could ever go in the service again, I think I'd want to be stationed on a carrier. It sounds so exciting. But how did that ever get started? And it wasn't the U.S., folks. It wasn't. So why don't you give us some background on the development of a carrier, the idea of taking off from a ship. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, you know, during World War I, the British were the first to take aircraft to sea, and they used float planes. And, of course, that was kind of difficult because you had to land on the water, and the ship had to stop and pick up the plane, and wasn't very, very efficient. So the British actually were the first to develop the aircraft carrier in World War I. And, of course, when we got into the war, we learned all from the British, and wow, that became a great idea. So right after the end of World War I, the Navy took an old Collier, and they converted it into an aircraft carrier, and that became the Langley, which was the U.S. Navy's first aircraft carrier. And it was really kind of an experimental platform that the guys could use to perfect their techniques of landing and taking off and develop aircraft. It was a very, very rudimentary kind of affair. But that led to bigger and better things.
Well, and the thinking around there were the capital ships. Going back hundreds of years, capital ships were the ships of the line, and they were battleships. And here comes something completely different, folks. And, Tom, tell us about the RMA.
The
Revolution.
Okay. That's a term that us historians use that means the revolution in military affairs. And basically what it means is when aircraft were invented, when the Wrights developed the airplane, they opened the whole environment to the air, which revolutionized how wars would be fought. Now, a lot of people think that the motive for getting aircraft to sea were being the eyes of the fleet. And this was true. You could get an aircraft up and you could spot and you could see where all the rest of the fleet were. But the most important thing was that the first use of aircraft was for gunnery spot. What happened right after World War I is the British had elevated their guns so that they could fire 3,000 yards. Now that's like 20 miles. You can't see a ship from 20 miles. So the only way you could hit something was to put an aircraft up and to watch what they call the fall of spot. And the United States Navy did this for the first time in 1919, and they actually flew float planes off of, well, not float planes, wheel planes, off of platforms that they'd built on turrets. Now, this was great, but, boy, you can only get one or two airplanes into the air that way, and if you met an enemy, boy, you'd be in big trouble. And that's what really pushed the development of the aircraft carrier. The first thing was to get air supremacy so you could provide spotting for the battleships. And, of course, that didn't last very long. In a few years, it became pretty obvious that bombing from an aircraft carrier was very much more dangerous. United States was kind of very lucky because, you know, after the end of World War One, it's kind of like today, big budget problems, a lot of money problems. Nobody really wanted to spend money on the military. And the aviators had a real difficult time trying to get anybody to spend money on this new ship that nobody had ever had. Well, it just so happened that two battle cruisers were being canceled. There was a big conference, a peace conference called the Washington Naval Conference, and because of that conference, we had to suspend construction on these two battle cruisers, which were kind of not needed anymore. And they happened to be named the Saratoga and the Lexington, named after famous Revolutionary War battles. And instead of destroying them, they turned them into aircraft carriers. And those became the two first large aircraft carriers in the United States Navy, and they were critical to the first battles that came 20 years later in World War II. Now, that's kind of a quick synopsis of how the U.S. got its first carriers.
Now, before we get into that, you did touch on the Washington Treaty on Naval Arms in 1920. Tell us about that, and what did that mean to the United States, and what did that mean to the Japanese?
Well, basically, there was a big conference held in Washington to limit the spread of arms. This was an artifact that came out of World War One, and basically, it established a level of number of ships that each navy could have. So the British could have so many ships of a type, the Americans could have so many ships of a type, and the Japanese and the French and the Italians, everybody who signed on. And the Americans and the British had parity, and the Japanese had less numbers of ships. And included in this was the number of aircraft carriers that each country could have. Well, the battlecruisers Saratoga and Lexington didn't fall into the number of battleships you could have. But we didn't have any aircraft carriers other than the Langley, which was a tiny little ship, and that actually permitted allowed us to convert these two large ships into aircraft carriers.
So the Japanese came on board. Oof, I didn't mean to say that, but they did. And I know I have a guest here in the studio. Just kind of, I know. Well, anyway, it's the morning. But getting back to, so the Japanese are part of this, but when it got down to the Admiralty, they really were not that convinced about aircraft carriers replacing the ships of the line, the battleships, to deliver gunnery ordnance. Isn't that correct?
Oh, that's absolutely. You know, there were great discussions. If you picked up the newspapers in that era, in the early 1920s, or any of the technical journals or so forth, there were big arguments between the air power enthusiasts, one of whom was Billy Mitchell, who I think we discussed the last time, and the conservative Navy guys over whether the battleships were absolutely obsolete or not. And actually, this kind of held back the development of carriers in the United States. But it took about 10 years to convince the folks that, no, the aircraft really were the way to go. Now, your listeners need to remember that when all this was going on, the aircraft of the day were kind of flimsy things. You know, they were fabric-covered biplanes. They didn't have very long endurance. They couldn't lift very heavy bombs. So there are really two sides to the story. And it turns out that both sides were probably right. The aerial enthusiasts were probably a little premature because they just didn't have the weapons that could sink a modern battleship. You know, a lot of people don't realize, but it takes a very special, very heavy bomb to penetrate 4 inches of deck armor on a battleship. And in 1920, that weapon didn't exist. And in fact, if you look if you go forward to World War II, and you look at where battleships were sunk, other than from torpedoes, there was, I think, one battleship was sunk by aerial bombs. So
I keep thinking
of a misnomer here.
I keep thinking of the Hood, but that was more of a heavy cruiser, right? The Hood.
She was sunk by gunfire.
Right, exactly. So
and even the Repulse and the Prince of Wales, which were attacked by three squadrons of Japanese. It took the Japanese all afternoon to sink those two ships. And one very critical aspect, those ships didn't have air cover. They weren't protected.
Well, we're going to get right to that. We have to take a quick break. It's half past. Can you believe that? It's already half past the hour, and we're going to have these IDs. We want you to stay on. By the way, if you have a question for our guest today, 877-573-7825 is Mr. Thomas Wildenberg, the author of Destined for Glory. We'll be right back after these important messages. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Veterans Radio Live from our flagship station, WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or find us online at AveMariaRadio.net.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer, that was a World War II song. It's all about that carrier force. They're coming in. By the way, they made a movie that I think that had John Garfield, and they're coming in on a wing and a prayer. All about carriers. I have with now as our guest today on Veterans Radio, Mr. Thomas Wildenberg, talking about his book, Destined for Glory, by the Naval Institute Press. By the way, folks, if you're looking for this particular book or any other book or the book, Ship Killers, with all about torpedoes by Mr. Wildenberg, you can go to veteransradio.net and click. Can they get to the bookstore, Dale?
Just go to veteransradiobookstore.com right now.
Right now.
And it'll take you right to the spot. You go through Amazon to purchase the books.
Absolutely. Purchase a book through Veterans Radio and Amazon. Tom, welcome back to the program. We got another 20, 25 minutes to talk about this, and I want to bring out that at this point in the carrier development, and it was very interesting. I saw a movie which piqued my interest on the Bismarck, and it was sunk, of course, by naval gunfire, but it crippled. There was a torpedo. I believe they called them a SPAD, a British ship. It had two wings. It was bi-wing. And this thing came in so low and so slow that there was this battleship. They couldn't lower their guns low enough to shoot it out of the sky. And it got a torpedo in, screwed up the mechanism in the back of the ship, and it couldn't make turns. So, I mean, here it was, a giant, the pride of the German fleet, the battleship Bismarck, sunk by a World War I bi-wing plane, torpedo plane. That was the key. Wasn't that it? The whole torpedo bombers. Isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so,
but, of course, it was a lucky shot.
Well, still, but it was delivered.
There were a whole squadron of planes, and only one managed to, if it had hit any place else but the stern, it wouldn't have done any damage because of the armor on the Bismarck.
Right, but it was a bit rudimentary, but it did say something there. and those that were paying attention, and apparently the Americans were, because on their carriers, folks, the Americans made changes. They made, well, tell us about that, Tom.
Well, one of the things that happened in the United States, that one of the issues was how do you develop these planes? You know, what planes do you develop? And the United States decided on their carriers. There were three kind of planes they put on. There were the fighters for protection. There were what they call scout bombers. And these planes would go out, and their primary job was to locate the enemy's carrier and to destroy it. And then there were torpedo planes, and the torpedo planes, they could sink any, they could go out and basically attack any ship. But, you know, the problem with torpedo planes, and you mentioned it, they were slow. They were slow and low. In order to drop a torpedo, the Devastator, which was the Navy's torpedo bomber at that point, you had to be at 60 feet and 90 knots to drop a torpedo, because they didn't know how to drop a torpedo at high speed. You know, think about it. If you're moving very, very fast and you drop an object, it's going to go straight down, and the torpedo would just dive. It wouldn't come back to the surface. So in order to launch those torpedoes, they had to go low and slow, and that made them very, very
vulnerable.
Vulnerable. And of course, you know, we know at the whole big story at Midway was how Torpedo 8 got decimated. There was only one survivor. So the real weapon, what the Navy discovered, was this dive bomber. And it was invented in the whole process of dive bombing only came about when the airplanes were strong enough to pull out of a dive. Because when you have a dive, you almost reach terminal velocity, like over 200 miles per hour. And in the early planes, that would just rip their wings off.
Pop them rivets, man. That pulled them rivets.
Well, I have a great picture of one of the first planes, U.S. planes, to drop a 1,000-pound bomb. And he pulled out. And can you imagine, this pilot is diving, and he pulls out. And all of a sudden, the plane gets really, really rough after he's left his bomb. He looks out, and half the fabric on his lower wing is gone. So until they fixed that problem, they couldn't kind of figure out the dive bombing. Now, the key to dive bombing is, and anybody who knows anything about ballistics, or even if you've thrown a rock, you know that when you drop an object, it doesn't fall straight. It follows what we call a parabolic arc. Well, it's very hard to kind of know just where that object is going to fall. Now, when you have a dive bomber, you're going almost vertical, so you don't have that problem. And that's the real big advantage of dive bombing, and this was perfected by the U.S. Navy. And maybe some of your listeners remember the World War II Stuka, the German Stuka. Well, where do you think they got it from?
They got right.
It from the U.S. Navy.
Yes. And
So by the beginning of World War II, the U.S. Navy knew just what kind of planes it had. So every carrier had one squadron of fighters, a squadron of regular dive bombers, a squadron of scout dive bombers, and a torpedo plane. And the scout dive bomber was unique. The Japanese didn't have this. You know, what the United States did in the late 20s, 1930s, they had these fleet problems. We call them maneuvers today. They went out into the Pacific and the Caribbean, and they kind of maneuvered, and they tested airplanes, and they tested tactics. And they figured out that, wow, the carrier that struck first was the one that always won. And one guy described what a carrier duel was like. He said it was like two one-armed blind men in a ring fighting. Because, you see, you couldn't figure. You got this great big ocean. You know, they didn't have radar in these days, and they didn't have satellites. And, you know, how far can you see from from the lookout station on a ship? 10, 15 miles?
Now,
how big is the ocean?
Now I know that we're going to be, and I want to get back to the planes, but there were some other innovations that the Americans did on the decks of these carriers, such as the crews, the type of uniforms. Tell us about that, the arresting wire, the whole thing. Tell us about that.
Well, the big difference, what happened was by the way, the big difference between the United States Navy and the Japanese Navy is the United States could handle more planes per carrier than the Japanese. So that when Midway came about, although they had four carriers and we had three, the number of aircraft was just about the same. And the guy who was responsible for this is a man by the name of Joseph Mason Reeves. And he took over what was called the Air Force or the Navy, the fledgling Air Force, in 1925. And remember we talked about the Langley, this experimental carrier?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the most planes they had ever put in the air until he took over was eight, just eight. And he was an old basically gunnery guy, and he knew that the volume of fire was really needed. And he was fortunate that while he wasn't a pilot, he was an observer. So he kind of crossed over both communities. He was both a gunnery guy and an aviation guy. And he insisted that they put more and more and more airplanes into the air. And they were getting ready to perform one of these fleet problems in 1928. And he insisted that they put 36 planes on the deck of the Langley so they'd have all these aircraft in the air. And he gave orders to his to the captain of the Langley, a guy by the name of Commander John Towers. He said, go up and put these 36 planes up. Well, Towers goes out, and they go, and the Langley was tied up in the dock in North Island. And they would wheel all these aircraft down the street and hoist them aboard. And Towers spent all morning, at the end of all morning, he had 27 planes up. And he goes back to Reeves' office. Reeves was his office was on the shore. And he says, we can only put 27 aircraft on board. Well, after lunch, the admiral takes his staff, and he was a cantankerous old guy. And they go up to the gangway, and they go up on the deck. And there Reeves loads all these aircraft and as starts moving them around. And as he starts moving them around, there's more deck space. And by the end of the afternoon, he had put 36 aircraft on this Langley. Now, by this time, they had figured out how, landing and taking off aircraft. And I've been on a carrier. It's the most unbelievable thing you've ever seen.
Tell us about it.
Orchestrated. It's unbelievable. A plane comes in and lands, and you're watching it land, and it goes up the deck, and you turn around, and another one's landing. And this was all developed in the 20s under Reeves' tutelage. And what they did is they orchestrated how you would land. First, they had to come up with these arresting wires. So every plane had a hook, and the plane would come in and land at the end of the deck, and this hook would catch on these wires, and the wires means of slowing down the airplane, and then they would unhook the plane, and there was a whole crew, and they would designate the crew by colors of their jerseys. So some men would direct the airplanes, some would push them, some would be responsible for taking the hook off, some would be responsible for arming and refueling. And this allowed them to take off and land quickly, get a lot of planes in the air quickly, and they call this today the cycle time. And this today is still what is very important in aircraft carriers today. They use basically the same methodology. And what it does is it allows you, like an aircraft carrier is maybe 1,000 feet long today, and they can operate 100 airplanes from that little space, as opposed to an airport that's got a 5,000-foot runway and all these parking areas.
We're talking right now, folks, with Thomas Wildenberg. Tom, we're coming up to our third break, believe it or not. He's the author of Destined for Glory. It's all about dive bombing Midway and the evolution of carrier air power. We're going to get right back with Tom in just a moment after these very important messages. Don't go away.
You're listening to Veterans Radio on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WMAX 1440 AM in Saginaw, Michigan, WDEO 98.5 FM in Naples, Florida, or listen online at AveMariaRadio.net.
Check it out, it's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Yeah, you're in the Navy, and you know what? Those aircraft carrier guys and gals, they really have a sense of pride that goes back to all that we're talking about here with Thomas Wildenberg, the author of Destined for Glory. Destined for Glory, which you can get on the Veterans Radio bookstore webpage. You want to do that, Tom? Believe it or not, we're down to our last little segment. I want to talk very briefly about these aircraft that you and I talked about way back. One, the first one is the Wildcat. I'm looking at this photo. I like this. This is stubby. It looks stout. It looks strong. What about the Wildcat?
Well, the Wildcat was a pretty tough fighter. One of the things that differentiated it between the Japanese planes is it had a lot of firepower, armored and self-sealing tanks.
Ah, that was big, the self-sealing tanks.
Absolutely. Again, your listeners may be familiar with the Japanese Zero, which was claimed to be the best fighter of World War II. But, boy, they called it like a lighter because if you hit it, it would burst into flame because it didn't have any self-sealing tanks and no armor. So although the Wildcat was heavier and not quite as maneuverable, it did quite well. And if you look at the records, I think you'll find that there were actually more Wildcats shot down more Zeros than the other way around.
It looks like it could really – it's this great little stubby aircraft that I just love the way it looks like it's the pilot and the plane are one here, folks, and it must have one heck of an engine because there isn't much else to the fuselage on the Wildcat, and it had retractable landing gear, correct?
Yep, and it was built by Grumman, and they used to call Grumman the Ironworks.
And why was that?
Because their planes were so strong.
Oh, okay. Good. And then the second one that we discussed with as this one is the SBD Dauntless. I think is that the one that President Bush was flying, the Dauntless?
Yep, it was a Dauntless dive bomber. And that plane was specifically designed, they called it an SBD for scout bomber because it was designed to have long range and be able to dive bomb. And the early doctrine was, the idea was that you would send these planes out as scouts, and they had about a 200-mile range, and the idea was that they would locate the enemy carrier, dive bomb it, and disable the flight deck. Not sink it, but just disable the flight deck, and then the other planes, the other rest of the squadrons from the carrier could come out and attack the enemy carrier and sink it. So it was a very special plane. It was very stable. And if you ever see pictures of it, it had what we call these dive flaps. If you go in an airplane,
I'm looking at one right now, Tom. I'm looking at the photo. So,
yeah, it's one on that's on the cover of the book. If you drove straight down, you'd go too fast. You'd exceed the plane's ability to pull out of a dive. So they invented these special dive flaps, and you can always notice them in an SBD because they've got perforations in them. And this made for a very stable diving platform. So the plane was very stable. It was very easy to aim. And this is why it was so successful at Midway, because they got good hits.
And it was, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute, about those famous 5, 6, 7 minutes in just a moment. Yep. Was the Dauntless, the SBD, was that a one-person crew or two?
Two. You had a gunner and a radio man in the back.
Now
and a pilot in the front.
Okay, what I'm looking at, some of my photos here, I see some with a machine gun in the back and some that do not. So there must be the later model.
The other thing is that the machine gun was dismountable, and they also had a sliding canopy, so it might not be visible.
They
would actually take that in and out of the airplane.
I'm going to go right to the TBF. Which is torpedo bomber fighter, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. That was this second generation torpedo plane, also made by Grumman. I had a friend of mine who actually sank a cruiser with that and got a Navy Cross. That came out after, basically after Midway. There were a few that flew from Midway Island. But they also were shot down because they didn't have any fighter cover. You know, even the best of the torpedo planes were vulnerable to enemy fighters. That's why you had fighters escorting them. And unfortunately, at Midway, we didn't have enough fighters, and they weren't close enough. And that's why all the torpedo planes got shot down. They really got shot down by the enemy's fighters.
Well, let's go right to Midway, folks, and this is where all of this that we've been talking about today has come together. The idea of scout planes, the idea of torpedo bomber, dive bombers, torpedo planes, etc. All this came into play during, and of course, carriers. If you look at Pearl Harbor, then you look at the Battle of Coral Sea, and then you look at Midway. Within 6 months. Folks, all this was decided, and then we still had the rest of the war, but all of this was decided by carriers. It wasn't the capital ships. Now take us to Midway. Here we are, the first group. Tell us who spotted who and who started this whole thing. We've got about 7 minutes. Go ahead, Tom.
Okay. Well, I think the easiest way to say this, they were fighting over Midway Island, which was kind of in the middle of the Pacific, and it was an advanced base. And the Japanese wanted to capture it because we had launched bombers from the carrier Hornet, another carrier Hornet, and it bombed the Japanese mainland, and they were very worried. So they wanted to get rid of this advanced base that we had, which was Midway Island out in the middle of the Pacific. And we, through radio intelligence, we knew that they were going to attack it. But they had a bigger fleet, and they had more aircraft carriers. So their idea was they were going to use their four aircraft carriers to attack the Midway base and defeat all the airplanes on the base, and then their big fleet could come in. Well, we only had three carriers available, so it was four carriers against three. And they didn't know we were there, so they went ahead and they started bombing Midway Island, and they didn't know where our carriers were. But we, because we had these scout bombers and we knew the importance of locating the enemy carrier first, we found their carriers before they did.
Now, remember, folks, how this is all. This is what Tom talked about in the beginning, is that the Japanese discounted the idea of a scout bomber, scout planes, and they still, the Japanese were, Yamato was not that convinced because he had battleships behind the carriers during the Battle of Midway to back it up. He wasn't completely, could be saying a lot of reasons why he got caught by surprise, and Tom. So go ahead, but I did want to bring that forward. Go ahead with.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He was waiting with his big battleships 100 miles away because they were still afraid of. See, everybody was afraid of land-based aircraft at this time. Anyway, so the United States sends four squadrons against these Japanese carriers, and one squadron gets lost. This is from the Hornet. And each American carrier operated independently. So you have all these four bombing squadrons, and you have torpedo planes going after these carriers. And, of course, the torpedo planes arrived first, the American torpedo planes, and they didn't have any air cover, and they were all shot down. But they brought the Japanese fighters down. So all of a sudden, and it was just by serendipity, you have these three American dive bombing squadrons arrive over the Japanese fleet, and within 6 minutes, they sank three of the four Japanese carriers. And that changed the course of the war.
360 seconds, changed everything, and there were more Japanese carriers. Yes, there were. We didn't sink them all, but they weren't part of Midway. And that's what's so hard for me to really totally comprehend how that did. And it had to do with the psychology of Nagumo and Yamato. Isn't that correct, Tom? Whoop! Did we lose Tom?
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, there you go. That both of these admirals, Yamato and Nagumo, they had more carriers later, but why was sinking these four so critical?
Well, because it won the battle. Two things. First of all, their other two carriers were laid up for repair, and this was a very critical battle. And then the next day, the Americans sank the last of the Japanese carriers. So without any air cover, Yamamoto had to retire. The Americans won the battle. They kept the Midway, and the war progressed. And without that, who knows what would have happened. But I want to talk about, if I might, a guy by the name of Dick Best, because he's really the hero. You know, you talked earlier in the program about American heroes. Well, when he was in a squadron, two squadrons were headed towards Japanese carriers, and they spotted two of these Japanese carriers. And he was in the trailing squadron. And the doctrine then was the trailing squadron was to hit the first carrier, and the first squadron was to hit the second carrier. Well, unfortunately, or by maybe lucky, his wingman lost oxygen. So they had to drop down so that his wingman could still, you know, wouldn't pass out. And when they dropped down, they gained speed. So unbeknownst, he went from the behind squadron to the forward squadron, and all of a sudden he's lining up on this aircraft carrier, and he's just about to enter his dive, and zoom, 15 planes go diving by him, and they're going after the first carrier, and he's smart enough to realize, oh my God, nobody's going to hit the second carrier, so he waits, he pulls back. He goes after the second carrier. Now, he's only got two wingmen with him. So there's only three planes now. 18 planes hit the other carrier, and they absolutely destroyed it. Well, he radios his two guys. He says, quote, don't let this carrier escape. And he pushes over into a near-vertical dive. He looks through his three-power telescope. He sights right at the point, the center of the Japanese carrier, just ahead of the bridge. He pulls the release of the bomb handle. And he calmly lays the plane over inside, and he watches the bomb go down, and boom, right in front of the elevator. And that's followed by two hits on the fantail, which is the stern of the ship, and it blows the enemy's carrier planes into the sea. And if it wasn't for Dick Best, only two carriers would have been hit and might have changed the whole course of the war.
Well, based on that, we're down to less than a minute and a half before the final gun here goes off here on the program. Tom, I think we've whetted the appetite. You all want some great winter reading. You want to get destined for glory. You want to go on the Veterans Radio website and go on the book. Give us that the bookstore again.
I will as soon as my mic comes on. There we go. VeteransRadioBookstore.com.
It's
also on our webpage, kind of scroll about halfway down, there's a link to the bookstore right there. Go in there, go through Amazon, buy the books. You know, I think you're going to love them. This sounds great. I need this one.
Oh, yeah. And, folks, so it's Destined for Glory. You want to hear these stories, or one after the other, by Tom, and it's something that you're not going to put down. We got 30 seconds. Tom, thank you very much for being on the program. Would you come on again?
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure, Bob.
Okay, it's always a pleasure.
And you have great people and great stories.
Well, thank you very much. That's always nice to hear. Oh, boy. Wow. 20 seconds to go. Don't forget next week, Dale's going to be our host. Dale?
All right. Medal of Honor. New recipients. He went back and looked at all the records. Going to pick up 19 new Medal of Honor recipients. We're going to be talking about them.
And we're going to have a little about Marine Corps training in the business right now with a 4-3-2. Until next time, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.